Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. For the first time in U.S. history, a former president has been convicted of a felony crime. Does the conviction suggest a shift for the presidency or for U.S. democracy? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On May the 30th, the United States made history. For the first time since the nation's founding, a former president was convicted of a felony. What does the criminal conviction mean for Donald Trump's ability to run for president and to govern if he wins? And why does the U.S. have such a challenge prosecuting former presidents when it has a history of prosecuting other former office holders? What does the term lawfare mean? And ultimately, what does this conviction mean? Does it make U.S. democracy more fragile or stronger? We're going to discuss the impact of Trump's felony conviction with our panel today. Ellen Rosenstein is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. He's the editor of Constitutional Commentary and Senior Editor and Book Review Editor for Lawfare. He's the author of The Virtuous Executive and The Case for Prosecuting Donald Trump with Jed Sugarman. And Peter Shane, Distinguished Scholar in Residence and Adjunct Professor of Law at New York University's School of Law. He is also professor and chair in law emeritus at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. He's the author of The Originalist Myth of the Unitary Executive and Democracy's Chief Executive Interpreting the Constitution and Defining the Future of the Presidency. And he's the host and creator of the podcast Democracy's Chief Executive, the podcast. Thank you both very, very much for joining us. Ellen Rosenstein, we'll start with you. This conviction of Donald Trump clearly has to have an impact on his ability to run for president. What kind of challenges does this make for a presidential campaign?
Well, first, and thanks for having me. There's a political question of what this will do to his poll numbers and for the willingness of Americans to vote for him. I'm not a political scientist or a pundit, so I don't know what the answer is. I like to think that it can't be good to be a felon 34 times over. But at this point, few things in American politics surprise me. So in that sense, we'll just have to wait to see what the polls say and what the electorate says in November. When it comes to the legal implications for his campaign, the answer is nothing, actually. There is no bar for a felon to run for president. Indeed, there's no bar for a person in prison running for president. This happened. Eugene Debs, the socialist presidential candidate during World War I, ran for president. He obviously didn't win, but he was a very serious third-party candidate. And at the time, it was well understood that he could run for president in his jail cell. And we can talk about whether this is a good or a bad feature of American law. But I think there's a consensus that legally, this really does nothing in terms of any kind of disqualification. What I do think is interesting is what this will mean practically for Donald Trump's ability to campaign. Obviously, it was quite striking that Donald Trump, someone who is really good at stealing the spotlight and talking a lot about all sorts of things, had to sit in a fairly dingy New York State courtroom for weeks, not saying anything. Presumably that had an impact in his campaign. There's always an interesting question of with Trump, did that actually hurt his campaign or help his campaign since he had to keep his mouth shut? But I think that's notable. And the next step obviously is sentencing. So the judge Judge Merchan, who oversaw the case, set the sentencing for, I believe for sometime in July, I think a few days before the Republican National Convention. There's no question that Trump will, in fact, be nominated at the RNC, no matter what Merchan says. But if Merchan imposes a term of confinement, certainly a jail term, that could meaningfully interfere with Trump's ability to campaign. Now, there's always a question of whether or not Judge Merchan would, when he would time that sentence to start, whether he would give Trump the opportunity to appeal up through the New York court system. Before the sentence begins, I think there are good reasons to think that he would probably delay that and should delay that, but obviously it's up to him. But of course, if Donald Trump was in prison, that would make it harder to campaign. But again, nothing would stop him. And so at the end of the day, it's going to be for the voters, not the judicial system, not the legal system, to decide whether Trump is elected for a second term in November.
Yeah, and Peter Shane, I think some of what this question raises is, I mean, first of all, the idea of somebody running for president who could potentially be, imprisoned or under house arrest or something is almost inconceivable for so many Americans. Why is it that former presidents really haven't faced potential, convictions? I immediately thought, past presidents have committed crimes, haven't they? Or so why is it so difficult? Why is it so inconceivable that we could prosecute a former president?
Like Alan, let me start by thanking you for having me as part of the discussion. I do not have any detailed knowledge of whether or not each of Donald Trump's 44 predecessors committed crimes or not. The one person most likely to have been indicted, of course, was Richard Nixon, who was pardoned. And that pardon was, if you read it, it's predicated on the notion that he would quite likely have faced indictment trial had he not been pardoned. I don't know if this is true in other countries, but in the United States, so much of our political life and political mobilizations become focused on the presidency that there is simply a different level of public reaction when the president is involved. When Spiro Agnew was found to have accepted bribes during his period as an office holder in Maryland, and was he basically took a plea but left the office of vice president, there was barely a gasp, a sigh around the country. I mean, vice president, who cares? And of course, you have governors like Rod Blagojevich in Illinois and other, lower level officials. And right now, of course, New Jersey Senator Menendez is on trial for bribery. There have been members of the House on trial, but none of those things galvanize the public's attention in the way that anything focused on the president does. The other thing I just want to say, just to echo something that Alan mentioned, and people can't see us talking, but I can say with some confidence, I'm the oldest member of this particular trio. And so I've lived through more presidential elections. And one measure of the changes in American politics that I always mention to my classes is what it took, within my lifetime to sink or at least severely injure a presidential campaign and what has happened since the Trump campaign of 2016. People may have remembered if they're old enough or have read about how much trouble Gerald Ford got in his 1976 race against Jimmy Carter for the unspeakable gaffe, supposedly referring to Poland as a free nation, even though it was still part of the Warsaw Pact. This is thought a horribly amateurish and, just a grave mistake. And, having George Bush act during a debate as if he'd never seen a price scanner in a grocery store. I mean, this was, how could any presidential campaign survive this? And from the moment Trump started descending the escalator in Trump Tower, we have just seen move after move that would have blown earlier presidents completely out of competition be either galvanizing for his campaign or, but certainly not, if in any event, not fatal.
Yeah, it always makes me think, ask, is this normal? As somebody, studies history and international relations myself, it's how abnormal is all of this? But Alan, you had some thoughts about convicted felons running for president.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's abnormal in particular is having someone who's so psychologically and temperamentally unfit for the presidency running for it. And I think that's what's inconceivable. The question of whether it's conceivable that a felon could run for president, I actually think that's a more complicated question. One can imagine situations in which a society is so polarized that they do, in fact, criminalize certain political views and certain political dissent as a way of trying to stay in power. And then the population kind of revolts against that and elects the person that they feel was treated and mistreated this way. Now, that, of course, is what Trump supporters think is happening. I don't think that is actually what's happening. I think Trump is simply a criminal. It's much more straightforward than that. One can imagine other situations in which While it might not be ideal to elect a felon to the presidency, that may very well be the right answer. So let me give two historical contexts, one from the United States and one from another country. So, when Eugene Debs, right, the socialist candidate, ran for president during World War I in the 1910s, he got 6% of the vote. That's not huge, but that's a respectable third party showing. And one can imagine a different situation in which, if American politics were different, he might have waged a more credible third party campaign. Now, he was put in prison because he violated what's called the Sedition Act. And specifically, he made some derogatory statements about the United States' involvement in World War I. He was generally a pacifist, as many on the far left were at that time. Now, the Sedition Act is generally viewed as one of America's more shameful moments, an absolute violation of the First Amendment, just an embarrassment, frankly, to a free speech culture. So is the fact that Eugene Debs was a felon, put in jail for violating a law, which he did in fact violate, should that have disqualified him for the presidency? I think in retrospect, the answer is no. I think it would have been absolutely appropriate if the country had said, screw this, we want this guy as our president. And the very fact that he's been put in jail for this unfair, unconstitutional law is exactly why we want him there, right? Another example is Nelson Mandela, who spent, I don't know how many years, but I think decades, in prison in South Africa for the equivalent of a felony. I don't know how the South African legal system works. But of course, for a righteous cause, right? The cause of fighting apartheid, and then became South Africa's first, president or prime minister, right? The first leader. Not despite of, but in some sense, because he had been a quote unquote felon. So I think that we should distinguish the mere act of being a felon from why you were a felon, right, in the first place, right? Trump is not a felon because he stood up to some unfair regime and fought for the people, right? He's a felon because he illegally or falsified business records to pay off a porn star who he was having an affair with, right? And even if these convictions were not in the New York case, but were for the things that I think most people care more about, let's say January 6th, those cases, I think that'd be an even stronger case for Trump not being president. But again, not because just because he is a quote unquote felon, but because of what he was prosecuted for. And I think that's a really important distinction to keep in mind.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the impact of the felony conviction of Donald Trump with Alan Rosenstein of the University of Minnesota and Peter Shane of New York University. And by the way, another example would be Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia. And so the nature of the felony certainly would matter. But Peter Shane, I'm in the backdrop of this, we're having conversations about whether or not the president is immune, what's the nature of the immunity, that issue certainly raised at the Supreme Court. And then that is cast against an increasingly growing powerful executive. So the question is, does the felony conviction make it less likely or more likely that presidents would be able to have greater immunity from these kinds of prosecutions? And what would that mean for the general power of the presidency, in the country? Yeah.
Those are great questions, Doug. And just to take them apart a little bit, of course, with regard to what has happened in New York, that was a prosecution by a state prosecutor. So, whatever, there may be a case that gets to the Supreme Court that raises questions about whether states can try presidents, either sitting presidents or former presidents. But that's not what's before the Supreme Court right now. What's before the Supreme Court is just the question of immunity in federal court. And of course, Trump's lawyers have taken the position that the president is absolutely immune from any criminal liability for acts while in office. Full disclosure here, I've been part of an amicus brief making this argument that I think that's a nonsensical position. And if there is a close question with regard to presidents and criminal immunity. That question exists only with regard to sitting presidents. The Office of Legal Counsel at Justice has opined on a couple of occasions that sitting presidents cannot be indicted while in office. And of course, Special Counsel Mueller relied on those opinions in explaining why there was no further proceeding on his watch with regard to anything Trump might have done with regard to obstructing justice or obstructing proceedings in connection with the 2016 campaign and the investigation of Russian interference. But those opinions rely on, you know, basically say there are other checks in place, one of which is if the president has committed a crime, he can be tried upon leaving office. Now, Trump has made the argument over and over that one could not function as president effectively unless there was this complete presidential immunity. And he's said that in light of what's happened to him in New York, and I guess, and this is another thing, it's hard to imagine a presidential campaign before this ever surviving this, but he's said, you know, if he's president, he'll have to now consider going after political opponents as if he hadn't considered it before. Somebody had the line, you know, every time Trump makes an accusation, it's a confession, because he's really projecting his own preferred strategy. The reason, there are multiple disincentives for any sitting president in any administration to go after a former president, not the least of which is that every sitting president is going to be a former president pretty soon. So the enthusiasm of any administration for going after a former president is naturally going to be curbed. Also, you know, a political cost to pay. If you go after, if you went after a former president for something, you know, that the public regards as minor, or, you know, just highly technical, I think there would be a big pushback politically. And this would be true, I think, even in a less polarized environment than the one in which we now live. Now, when it comes to, again, just to make his accusation as concrete as possible, Trump always likes to say, or his supporters always like to say, well, what about, you know, Obama going after Anwar al-Awlaki in a drone strike? Anwar al-Awlaki was a U.S. citizen living in Yemen. He was head of or a senior official of al-Qaeda in Yemen and was engaged in seemingly in recruiting long distance in the United States. Well, you know, there are a couple of things to be said about that. One is a question might be posed. It's not going to be posed, I think, with regard to the January 6th trial, or indeed with regard to the Mar-a-Lago documents case, if we ever get to it. We have a catch and kill operation seemingly going on in the Florida courtroom. But with regard to, the president's functioning, let's say, as commander in chief, or performing another function vested in the president by the Constitution, then there might be a closer question as to whether there is immunity for an act that is within that constitutionally specified power. That's got nothing to do with anything that Trump has been accused of. And the second thing, I suppose, to be said is that, you know, before any sitting president engages in a highly controversial act, they're quite likely, I'm thinking back to, you know, Andrew Jackson, before he, you know, sort of fired his secretary, his treasury secretary, for not moving money out of the national bank into state banks. I mean, presidents get legal opinions from their attorneys general. And assuming the opinion is in good faith, which it's quite likely to be, the chances that any president would have the intent, the culpable intent required for an indictment seems quite remote.
And Alan, back to this question about the nature of the felony, makes me think that with respect to, you know, presidential culpability, criminal culpability, is it fair to say we should make a distinction between what the president is doing as an act of state? So what Peter Shane's describing, things like a drone strike, et cetera, I mean, this is a policy decision versus the accusations against Trump, none of which could be, you know, could be accurately described as a part of the function of the presidency as an act of state. Is that a fair distinction in thinking about what presidents should be criminally vulnerable for?
So that's certainly one fair distinction. The trick with immunity doctrines, and this is true generally, the presidential immunity is a kind of subcategory of a broader immunity that we often give to public officials. The trick with immunity doctrine is where to draw the lines, because you want to draw them in such a way that on the one hand, you are preserving the public official's ability and willingness to act vigorously and aggressively without excess fear for their own liability. But at the same time, of course, you don't want to create impunity. And on the third hand, as it were, you need a rule that is administrable in the sense that you need a rule that is simple enough for the president and her advisors to be able to grasp at the moment of decision and be able to predict that their reading of the law will match what the ultimate decision maker, the court, will read. This is a very tricky problem. And it's made trickier by the fact that the president is sui generis. They have such powers, such responsibilities, such importance, such both upside and downside potential, we might say. And there's not a lot of case law on this because, fortunately, we haven't had that many presidents who are such flagrant lawbreakers and that need to be punished. So we don't have a lot of case law to go on here. You know, legal analysts, you know, people like Peter and myself, we sort of have to kind of make up a conceptual apparatus that we think does the best job and hope for. Now, one way of doing that is as you just said, to distinguish between the nature of the act, right? Is it done in the personal or official capacity? And that seems to be at least what the lower courts so far, with respect to in particular some of the January 6th cases that have actually gone through the courts on this issue, have thought. The problem there, though, is that it can be very difficult to cleanly separate the personal from the official when it comes to the president, because the president, again, is this unique official who's always on. It's a 24/7, 365-day job, right? And because a huge amount of the president's power and influence comes from his standing and general public reputation, it can be hard to cleanly divide the personal from the official. Now, there are going to be certain easy cases, right? You know, if the president, you know, punches someone on the golf course because that person made him mad, yeah, that's probably not in the official capacity. But there are actually tricky questions. What if the president gives a speech about some scandal that he's involved with and defames someone, but he gives that speech publicly because he's trying to get something passed through Congress? I think it's actually not entirely obvious to me that there's not necessarily some official capacity. At the same time, though, you don't just want to let the president cite that as a get-out-of-jail-free card. So are there other ways that we could draw the immunity distinction? I have argued in some of my scholarship that a different way, and one way that has some advantages, though there's some disadvantages as well, is to focus on presidential motives. And instead of asking just, is this an official act or a personal act, to say, did the president have a good faith belief that he was acting within his power, that he was acting lawfully, right? And if he had such a good faith belief, and there's some connection, even a relatively attenuated one, to the president's official duties, we should err on the side of immunity, right? Now, the downside of this is that requires a analysis of presidential motive, and that's something that courts often really don't like to do. But it's just a matter of trade-offs. There's not gonna ever be a immunity regime that perfectly balances everything we want with 100% fidelity and is easy to administer. So you kind of have to pick your poison. But I think the thing that is very important not to lose sight of is that we don't need to solve this problem to resolve the Trump cases. So much of what Trump does is so far beyond the line, right? Either it's just completely personal, or even if it's official, it's so obviously illegal and everyone knew that at the time, and there's no Article II argument that it's somehow maximally protected by the Constitution, that we don't need to identify the every extent of the rule to resolve these cases. And I think that's a very, very important point. And this is an issue that comes up frequently in the law. Sometimes there are just easy cases, and you can resolve those cases without having to answer every theoretical problem that law professors might want to pose. And I think with very few exceptions, everything that Trump is being prosecuted for, whether it's the New York case, whether it's the Florida documents case, whether it's the federal January 6th case, whether it's the state Georgia Atlanta January 6th case, there is more than enough there that Trump is just not on any reasonable theory of immunity immune from. And I think we should focus on that and then leave, you know, Peter and I can then write the law review articles trying to figure out all the hypotheticals.
Peter, you want to follow up?
Well, I just wanted to say I agree with everything that Alan just said. And this is why, to me, one of the sort of scariest, least helpful things that was said during the oral argument in the Trump immunity arguments before the Supreme Court is when Justice Gorsuch said, you know, we'll be crafting a rule for the ages. They're not supposed to be crafting rules for the ages. They're supposed to be deciding the case in front of them. And where, given the range of potential difficulties that Alan has, you know, accurately laid out, the prudent, one hastens to say, judicious thing for the court to do would be to stick to the case in front of it, which is, you know, not so hard to decide, and allow, again, I may be naive, I'm always the optimist in my family, but I don't think we're going to see a long string of felonious presidents or even presidents skirting the line that are somehow going to be restrained in their official activities if this doctrine remains a little blurry.
With that, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to break down the term lawfare that keeps getting referenced. What is lawfare? You know, how much is there a political motivation behind these prosecutions? And how much is it setting a precedent for the use of the courts to go after political opponents?
Does Trump's conviction signal a shift or a precedent? Or is he uniquely criminal? Will future presidents need to fear prosecution? Stay with us.
We could very well have a sitting president under felony indictment and ultimately a criminal trial. It would grind government to a halt.
If she were to win, it would create an unprecedented constitutional crisis that would cripple the operations of our government. She is likely to be under investigation for many years, and also it will probably end up, in my opinion, in a criminal trial. I mean, you take a look. Who knows? But it certainly looks that way.
That was former President Donald Trump speaking in Nevada on November 5, 2016, about his opponent, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. Donald Trump's allies are accusing Alvin Bragg and the Democratic Party of something called lawfare. What is lawfare? And is it an accurate term to describe prosecution of Donald Trump? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the criminal felony conviction of Donald Trump and what this means for the presidency, what this means for prosecuting former presidents, and what it specifically might mean for the 2024 campaign and beyond. Our guests today are Alan Rosenstein. He is an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School. Also, a book review editor for Lawfare, and we'll be discussing Lawfare in just a moment. And Peter Shane, a distinguished scholar in residence and adjunct professor of law at the New York University School of Law. Now, Alan, I'm going to turn to you to ask about Lawfare because I know you write, you know, for Lawfare, and you're on at least one of the wonderful Lawfare podcasts, Rational Security. I'll do a little pitch for that, one of my favorites. What is Lawfare? What is that term, and is it being accurately applied by Republican commentators following the conviction?
Sure. So Lawfare has at least two meanings, and here's is a bit specific to myself. I, of course, write for a website called Lawfare. That's one meaning of Lawfare, and when we called ourselves Lawfare, it was because it was a nice way of describing our two interests, which was law and national security. But of course, when people talk about Lawfare and they're not referring to the website, what they're usually referring to, or at least what the term originally meant, sort of among scholars and analysts, was the use of the law for, in particular at the time, military and foreign policy purposes. So the idea was that one can wage war or conflict through sort of conventional means, bombs and soldiers, but one can also use the instruments of the law itself, whether international law or nation law, for a military or foreign policy purpose. As that term has continued to be used, and I think especially as that term is often used by sometimes Trump himself, often his supporters, when they accuse Trump, when they say that Trump is being a victim of Lawfare, what they're referring to is the politicized use of certain very aggressive legal instruments, in particular prosecution. Now, I want to separate whether that's a coherent use of the term from whether that is in fact what is happening here. It is definitely a coherent use of the term. One can easily imagine instances of Lawfare. One can certainly, and it's easy to look to other countries where there really has been Lawfare, right? The use of the state's legal powers pretextually for political purposes. And I'm sure in American history, there have been uses of Lawfare. The interesting question, of course, is whether Trump is a victim himself of Lawfare. I think on the whole, the answer is no, he is not. I think that Trump is an extreme president. He acted in extreme ways. He broke a lot of laws. And I think that it is, in most cases, appropriate to hold him to account for those laws. The mere fact that the prosecution of Trump will have political ramifications, or is being brought by, in a sense, his political opponents, at the end of the day, the Department of Justice in particular, although it is quite independent as far as these things go, is still part of the Biden administration, and that creates certain awkwardnesses. And of course, the state prosecutors in New York and Atlanta are themselves directly elected, and of course, there's political valence, and we can talk about whether they've always behaved in the most ideal way possible, and there are some criticisms there. But the mere fact of that there has a political valence does not mean that Trump is a victim of Lawfare. So you won't really have to show that the prosecution is being used specifically as a political instrument. Now, there have been some concerns, not just raised by Trump and his supporters, but also by people on the other side, that the New York prosecution in particular is the sort of thing that would not have been brought against any other person, and that it is Trump's notoriety, and it is particularly the fact that Trump is the Republican frontrunner that is causing a Democratic DA to bring this charge. I think on the whole, the Trump prosecution is appropriate. I think the actions were bad, and he should be brought to account. But I will not pretend that this was the prosecution that I was most excited about. I don't think anyone wanted this to be the prosecution of Donald Trump, or that this anyone wanted this case to be the one. It's a little bit like getting Al Pacino on tax evasion. Fine, he evaded taxes, but that's kind of not the point. So I do think there are fair questions to ask, but on the whole, I think that Trump's criminality, frankly, far outweighs, in the grand scheme of things, any concerns about whether he is the victim of Lawfare. Now, there's a separate question whether or not this will start a cycle of Lawfare itself, right? Whether this will set a precedent, or it'll be perceived to set a precedent that administrations prosecute their political opponents from the previous administration. Now, earlier in our conversation, Peter articulated some good reasons why that might not happen. But of course, we don't know. It's very hard to tell the future, especially in a very polarized time as ours. And there is something to taking that concern seriously. But at the end of the day, you can't just continuously unilaterally disarm because you think that the other side is going to abuse the thing you are doing righteously. At some point, you just have to take the action you think is appropriate based on the oath that you took as a prosecutor or as a district attorney and let the chips fall where they may. And that sounds naive, but because it's impossible to predict the future, the alternative is to get so paralyzed as to sort of make any action impossible.
Peter, you had some thoughts on this as well.
Yes. So on the lawfare thing, so I'm blanking out on the comic's name, but there's a wonderfully funny new stand-up special on Netflix by a comic whose mother's name is Karen, who is quite liberal. And when she realized what Karen had come to mean in the culture, was just outraged. And Alan, as a senior editor at Lawfare, probably has to be a little restrained in bragging about it. So I would just like to brag about it a little bit. Because I think it originally started when folks like Ben Wittes and Jack Goldsmith at Harvard saw the need for basically a blog that would discuss national security issues at a time after I don't think this is late or right after the Bush administration, but it had a kind of centrist valence or a little right of center valence. And it spawned, although there was kind of some overlapping writers and staff, a sort of left of center blog called Just Security. But they were both started out, I think, as very self-conscious attempts to be kind of straight down the middle, accurate, scholarly, but accessible national security blogs. And then what happened, I think, in Ben Wittes's view, which I think a lot of us would agree with, is that the Trump administration exposed a whole new possibility for the insecurity of American democracy. And it vastly expanded the range of issues that Lawfare covers. And you can see the same thing happening in Just Security. And, it's an absolute, go-to for anyone, I think, interested in separation of powers issues generally, not just, the foreign affairs and military questions. With regard to the New York prosecution and its justifiability, which Alan was talking about, I haven't researched this independently, so, I can't give you a citation, but I've read that Bragg has brought 34 other prosecutions under the same legal provisions as the one brought against Trump. And I will just say, doing my own podcast in spring of 23, shortly after the indictment came down in Manhattan, I wanted to have a discussion about this very question. And I set it up. I knew, I'm sort of a friendly acquaintance of Norm Eisen, who's been strongly anti-Trump. So I thought, okay, that'll be one side. But a good friend of mine from the Ohio State faculty, and I hope I'm not, I don't think I'm giving away private information. I know him to be a Republican. He's more conservative than I am. A wonderful scholar, really wonderful human being named Rick Simmons. I thought he would be a good person to have, to have. So I could say I had a bipartisan panel. And I expected, I had not talked to Rick about the case prior to it. I lazily assume that as a Republican, pretty strong law and order kind of guy, he might think that this was, outside the mainstream or imprudent. What I hadn't realized, or what I'd forgotten about Rick, is he was a former ADA in Manhattan. And his view of the case was, this is absolutely bread and butter stuff. That this, if you listen, it's still available. He described it, if not quite as a slam dunk, he thought this was a very easy case. It's sort of like, a heart valve replacement. For the patient, it seems momentous, but for the surgeon, it's what they do every day. And so I'm also just not buying that that lawfare is an accurate description for what went on in New York.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the impact of Trump's felony conviction with Alan Rosenstein of the University of Minnesota and Peter Shain of New York University. And I guess in this last section, we can do a little speculation about the legal impact. But specifically, Alan, I'll ask you this first. What's kind of interesting about this for me was one of Biden's arguments against Trump is that he is a threat to democracy, and maybe his strongest argument. And in reaction to the conviction, Trump and his allies are saying, well, we're gonna go after all of our political opponents. As a result of this, aren't they reinforcing that argument that they really are, you know, dangerous to democracy? And maybe that's the greatest impact out of all of this, is to kind of make Biden's case for him?
I mean, it's certainly true for people like you and me and Peter, but we're just three votes. And Peter's in New York, you're in California, and I'm in Minnesota. None of these are going to be swing states. I hate to say it, but at the end of the day, you win elections by winning elections. You don't win elections by making some intellectual argument about your opponent, unless that lands among the electorate. And what I don't believe the galaxy brain takes that having 34 felony convictions helps you. I think it probably hurts you. And I think the polling that we've seen so far suggests that there is at least some cost to Trump, especially among the sort of theoretical suburban soccer mom kind of demographic, to sort of say crudely, that may very well decide this election in a few states. And so, yes, I totally agree with you that Trump's deranged statements absolutely make Biden's case. The question is that the case that Biden needs to make to win the election? And that's a question for, unfortunately, political scientists and pundits and campaign people, not law professors like Peter and me. To me, I will say, I think it was clear who Trump was in 2016. I think it's clearer now, and even I was a little surprised at January 6th and how he handled that. But it was really on election night of 2016 that I realized that there's just a large percentage of my fellow countrymen that frankly don't care that much about small d democracy. Right now they happen to be on the right because it's the right that presented them their candidate. It'd be an interesting hypothetical to ask, well, what if we had a populist from the left? You could imagine those things. It certainly happened in history. Would people on the left also react this way? I suspect more would than the left likes to admit. I think that there are very few people in the world who really value neutrality, true process-based neutrality. People say they do, but then when push comes to shove, they often don't. But you go into war with the electorate you have, not the electorate you want. And so I am disturbed, and you have been disturbed, that at least 40%, at least 45% of Americans will vote for this person. But that hasn't changed that much, frankly, in 8 years. And my worry is just that everything about Trump is baked in. Now, again, in such a close election, you only need, honestly, a few tenths of a percentage point in certain key swing states to shift the election. But that certainly doesn't make you comfortable. And it doesn't make you comfortable at this election, and it really doesn't make you comfortable about the future of American democracy. Because if anyone thinks that, the moment Trump shuffles off the stage, everything will go back to normal, they are highly deluded, right? There are deep structural factors that make American democracy extremely, extremely fragile. As I think Ben Wittes, the editor-in-chief of Lawfare, he wrote, and I still think the single best description of Trump, Trump's malevolence is thankfully tempered by incompetence. Which limits his danger to some extent. But there will be future Trumps, and some of them will be just as malevolent, but far more competent.
Please, Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think second-term Trump would not have the saving grace of incompetence to that same degree, in part because there's a coalition of far-right groups that have gotten together to put together both, you know, personnel and an agenda, a policy agenda, sort of ready to plug and play that will, you know, make up for, you know, whatever Trump's attention deficit disorder may be. I do think, you know, whether or not he is competent would matter less if he's surrounded by subordinates who have learned through the experience of the first Trump administration how to work the levers of power more effectively in pursuit of that particular agenda.
Peter, speaking about incompetence, ability to govern, et cetera, I know you've written quite a bit about the executive, the role of the executive. If Trump is elected but is sentenced to prison, how does he govern? What kind of impact would that have on governance? And to be certain, my understanding is if he's elected, that does not have an impact on whether or not Judge Mershon could send him to jail. So how do you govern from prison?
Right. So, you know, maybe a mob boss has written a book about this that other chief executives could follow. Obviously, this would be difficult. I don't know. I mean, of all of the things we've speculated about, probably the one on which we have the least firm ground for speculation is what Judge Mershon would do on sentencing. I could well imagine that if he did sentence Trump to any kind of liberty restraint, be it incarceration or even house arrest, that there would be an open constitutional question whether a state could impose that sentence during the incumbency of the president. I think that's an interesting question I hope we don't face. I think Trump Trump has shown himself to be, you know, uniquely gifted at marketing. He's a horrible lawyer. And I say that because I assume he is taking his own advice in performing in a way that maximizes his vulnerability to a sentence of incarceration. If he were to show any contrition, any acknowledgement of error, then the fact that he is a former president, the fact that these are his first 34 convictions, as far as this court is concerned, there's no other blemish on his legal record. The fact that these are not crimes of violence that we're talking about, all of this would, and just the logistical difficulty of dealing with Secret Service protection for someone who's in prison, all of that argues for not incarcerating. But somebody who is unwilling to say, even that, you know, reasonable minds could have reached the consequence that they've reached because I did perform the acts that I'm accused of, somebody's unwilling to say that is just crying out for more serious punishment in the name of deterrence. So, I hope we don't face this question. I do think the issue would be posed, and maybe it would be posed with regard to the Georgia prosecution too, and once that eventually happens, how far a state's criminal justice system, including its prison system, can extend over a sitting president.
And I'll ask the same question of you, Alan, but add to that, one thing that we do know is, at least on the surface, if Trump were elected president, I believe it's 37 countries would bar him from traveling there because they bar felons from traveling to that country. So I guess it'd be awfully difficult to conduct a foreign policy not being able to go to those countries. So how would this work?
Obviously, I can't speak to the legal regimes in those countries. Look, I suspect if the president of the United States wants to visit you, you're gonna let us plane land. But, you know, getting back to the question, look, I think it's worth doing a little bit of math here, right? So there's a 50% chance that Trump will win the presidency. I think there may very well be a 50% chance that Judge Mershon sentences him to some sort of confinement or jail time for exactly the reasons Peter pointed out. Just the lack of contrition, the just insane statements Trump's been making, the many contempt, you know, Trump was held in contempt multiple times during the trial. This would be the sort of defendant that in any other circumstances would be begging to be put in prison. You combine those probabilities. I mean, there's a easily 25% chance, you know, even if you're more conservative, 10% chance, absolutely, that Trump is going to be convicted, sentenced to jail, and elected president. And we're going to have to figure that out. Now, this is a situation in which there is, as Peter said, nothing to go on. I mean, this is just a completely wide open question. You have to go back to Ulysses S. Grant for a president to have been, interestingly, arrested while president. He was speeding in a stagecoach, apparently. He was having a fun time riding around D.C. That didn't really go anywhere. And it's, again, it's hard to know exactly what to make of that. But it just shows how far you have to go back to find a comparator. So in situations like this, what lawyers and judges tend to do is they tend to start thinking what's called structurally. They look at the kind of overarching principles of the Constitution, of how it's structured, and they try to just figure out how to make the machine work with the least amount of fuss. In my view, I have trouble imagining any other circumstance than the state court, or ultimately as the backstop, the federal courts, holding that any incarceration, and this would be true of a state conviction, but also a federal conviction, would just have to be held in abeyance while the person is president. I'm not saying it's a watertight argument. There are good arguments against that. I mean, the states are their own sovereigns and we have a federalist system. There are all sorts of good arguments, right? There'll be many law review articles can be written about this. I just, at the end of the day, have trouble thinking that the Constitution, which vests the executive power in the president, which makes the president commander in chief, which gives the president the nuclear football, right, could possibly allow a state government or even a federal prosecution of keeping the person in prison, right? There is a famous phrase, vox populi, vox Dei, right? The voice of the people is the voice of God. At the end of the day, you sort of have to give the people the choice of who should be president. And obviously we have lots of restrictions on that, but it just seems untenable to me that a election after a prosecution, that of all the options, holding the sentence in abeyance while the person carries out their term is not ultimately the least worst option. And I will say that is what happens in a lot of countries, right? There are a lot of countries where the rule is presidents are immune while they are president. And when they stop being president, they can go to jail. I mean, that's happening, for example, in Israel right now with Benjamin Netanyahu and indictments for prosecution and corruption. And I think the fact that that is a standard feature of a lot of other systems that have had to deal with this problem is an indication that, again, it's not a good option, but it may very well be the least worst option.
Yeah, Peter Shane, then going off of what Alan just said, I believe it was Justice Gorsuch that suggested on the immunity case that if presidents could be prosecuted, it would give a huge incentive for them to never surrender the presidency. And that is something we've seen internationally quite a bit. Presidents wanting to hold power, numerous African leaders, Asian leaders that wanted to hold power because they knew that they faced prosecution afterwards. And arguably, I don't think it would describe that well with, that's not exactly what's going on within Israel. But in any case, what is the possibility then that if the idea is if he's president, you can't imprison him, but as soon as he's done, he goes to prison, seems to also give a pretty strong argument against him ever surrendering the presidency.
I'll just say this briefly because I'm guessing we're in our last few seconds of our discussion. But I think Trump may well have learned an unfortunate lesson from the Supreme Court case that basically disallowed Colorado to disqualify him under the 14th Amendment, which is the constitutional restrictions on the presidency and being elected. Those disqualifications are very hard, if ever, to enforce. And I think anyone who is confident that a second-term Trump would be governing under the conviction that it's his last term, I think they're fooling themselves. I have no doubt that he would try to find a way to continue into the future, immunity or not.
Alan Rumsfeld, I'll give you the last word. We've got about 90 seconds or so here. We sort of started off talking a little bit about speculating, you know, going forward. So I'll give you that same question. What's the likelihood that if Trump is elected, that he ever spends time in prison, or that this becomes a pretty powerful motivation for him to to do what he can to make sure there's not another election?
I don't know. I at some point, I lose the ability to speculate. All I know is that if Trump is reelected, that is going to put enormous strains on American constitutional democracy, and we'll all have to do the best we can.
I think it's actually a good place to end, because ultimately the real question is not that we know what's going to happen. It's that we're now thinking about, speculating about things that were inconceivable prior to the election of 2016, and certainly prior to this conviction of Donald Trump on May the 30th. We've been discussing the impact of the criminal conviction of Donald Trump, the first former president to be convicted of a felony. That was on May the 30th when the U.S. made history. Our guests today have been Alan Rosenstein. He's the associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School, the editor of the Constitutional Commentary and senior editor and book review editor for Lawfare. He's the author of The Virtuous Executive and The Case for Prosecuting Donald Trump with Jed Sugarman, also is part of the team that produces the wonderful podcast Rational Security. And Peter Shane, distinguished scholar in residence and adjunct professor of law at the New York University School of Law. He's also professor and chair in law emeritus at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. He's the author of The Originalist Myth of the Unitary Executive and Democracy's Chief Executive, Interpreting the Constitution and Defining the Future of the Presidency. He's the host and creator of the podcast, Democracy's Chief Executive, the podcast. Thank you both very much for sharing your time and your expertise on the topic.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.